Wall Street veteran Bernard Madoff has been arrested and charged with running a $50 billion Ponzi scheme.
Congress wants to know what caused the Enron meltdown.
Now, while the collective rage currently is focused on WorldCom,
Tyco CEO Dennis Kozlowski was convicted of looting hundreds of millions of dollars.
This is one of the biggest fraud cases ever.
Their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
Find out more on this week's episode of White Collars, Red Hands.
Great revolutionaries have come along in many disciplines and completely changed the direction of their fields of expertise. Physics has Albert Einstein. Nursing has Florence Nightingale. TikTok cringe videos currently have JoJo Siwa. Every path to things well-remembered are started and strewn with such visionaries, but there are also those who devote their lives with equal fervor for the less tasteful side of life. For every Hall of Fame, there is a Hall of Infamy. And today, we talk about one such dubious pioneer, Victor Lustig, the seeming inventor of the idea of the modern-day con man who is attributed with their Ten Commandments, left a trail of spurned marks and lovers across two continents in the early 20th century, the stories of which seem almost too outlandish to be real, but have been corroborated by many media outlets throughout the Reign of Terror. From magic boxes to conning gangsters, he is best known for his successful deals to sell the Eiffel Tower twice, like so much beachfront property in Arizona. So sit back and buckle up as we present the story of the smoothest con man in history. Don't worry, federal agents' words, not ours.
Now you've got that beachfront property in Arizona song stuck in my head.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know how many country music fans we have out there that listen to this. I feel like that Venn diagram is very small in the middle, but nevertheless, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, but surprisingly, I looked for it. I lived in Arizona. It's not there.
There's none?
None.
Oh.
It's crazy.
Really? I gotta look at a map.
You're not serious. Are you playing along with the joke?
Okay, no.
You're not?
I thought there was a little bit of ocean that touched it.
No, that's the whole point of the song. It's a joke. Like, also, you beachfront property in Arizona because it's fucking landlocked in a desert.
Oh, well.
There's like a couple of larger lakes, not anything like the Great Lakes, but no.
It's right by Mexico.
So?
Surrounded by water.
What the fuck does that mean?
Surrounded by water.
Oh my God.
All right, I didn't know. Now I learned something today.
Bro.
Really? There's none?
I'm the one that's supposed to be bad at geography.
And I'm usually so good at it.
Please look at a map. Absolutely. You know what? I'll put a map up on the screen. Does that look like it has water around it? No.
This looks like there's water.
They cut off Mexico.
All right, yeah. All right, just so you all know, no ocean touches Arizona.
I don't think anyone else needed to be told that. I don't think so. Except, I think you're the only one here that did not know.
Incorrect.
You know what? If you also didn't know, why don't you leave a comment? I'm sure no one will make fun of you. Just leave a comment. It's all right.
You know what? I can't know everything, Kashan. I can't know everything.
Well, you're about to know everything about Victor Lustig.
Hell yeah.
This guy's crazy.
Is he?
Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. My name is Kashan.
And I'm Nina.
And like I just said, this is going to be all about Victor Lustig.
Hell yeah.
So the exact origins of Victor Lustig are unknown. They're shrouded in mystery. Most of our hints to his birthplace, childhood, and status are from his own words. But as you would expect of a revolutionary con man, we can't really trust those. All of the stories have him born in the town of Hostene, part of the province of Bohemia in the modern-day Czech Republic, in 1892, Austria-Hungarian parents. The month of which he was born, we don't really know. And the stories have him growing up in anywhere from a house that is basically a shack with some of the poorest parents in town to being the son of the mayor or burgomaster of Hostene to growing up in a mansion as part of the aristocracy. He told a version of these at very different times.
I was going to say whatever he needed to tell people to woo them, probably.
Yep. Yeah. We really don't know. We don't even know if Victor Lustig was his real name.
Probably not.
As people who knew him later would say, that it was actually Robert Miller.
Very exotic.
However, when independent researchers went to Hostinay and pored over the records of the school children from the town from the years he would have been there, which I guess were still preserved, they came up with no evidence of either. So it's highly possible that all of this is a complete fabrication and the truth is just kind of lost to time. Who knows? But we will refer to him, as most people do, as Victor Lustig through the rest of this episode. Either way, what we do know is that by 1908, Victor, if that is his real name, found his way to Paris. It is believed he could have been there attending university, more in line with his story of at least a middle-class background, and also supported because he did learn to speak multiple languages fluently. He could speak French, Italian, and English.
I mean, that's even... the way Europe is today, though, everybody is bi or tri. If you are educated, you are.
Everyone's bi? That's crazy.
Well, everybody's a little bit bi anyway. And then they're all bi and trilingual.
Well, yes. But in Bohemia, though, right? You know, a slightly different section of Europe. Known for its eccentricity. And he was truly living out his Bohemian lifestyle, traveling around and being artistic or. There's a better definition
for the word Bohemian. Was he doing a lot of Bohemian Rhapsody?
Why don't you tell me what that means? I'll wait.
I think it means that you just killed a man and that you held a gun against his head and pulled the trigger and then he was dead.
So it was also here in Paris that he gained a knack for prestidigitation, also known as sleight of hand, and was said to be able to make a deck of cards do everything but talk.
Whoa, he can make the cards kiss each other?
Yeah, he can make the cards commit larceny. That's crazy. Damn. Anything but talk, literally anything. At the young age of 19, Lustig dipped his toes into crime, first by pickpocketing, then dove headfirst into the trouble of gambling. He... also at this time found out the trouble of women. He had picked up a lover who happened to already have a steady boyfriend.
Nice.
And that same boyfriend left Lustig a gift for his escapade with his girlfriend in the form of a scar on the left side of his face that he would carry with him for the rest of his life. Whether because of this fear or more jilted love affairs, loan sharks, or a growing desire to see more of the world, Lustig took his show on the road. Or should I say the tide, packing up his quick wits and using them to scam rich Europeans and Americans on transatlantic cruises in 1909. It was on these cruises where Victor would meet the man that would become his mentor, Nicky Arnstein. Nicky was an American gambler and con man who is known for being married to Broadway star and comedian Fanny Brice for 9 years. Fanny's life, by the way, would later be loosely adapted into Funny Girl.
Interesting.
In which Rachel from Glee just played the lead role in the 2023 revival.
She did.
Nicky had started a Ten Commandments of Con Men, which Victor updated, and he's now accredited with it. So Victor Lustig created the Ten Commandments of the Con Man.
Okay, let's hear them.
And they are as follows. Number one, be a patient listener. It is this, not fast talking, that gets a con man his coup. Never look bored. That's number two. Three, wait for the other person to reveal any political opinions, then agree with them. Four, let the other person reveal religious views, then have the same ones. Five, hint at sex talk, but don't follow it up unless the other person shows a strong interest. Six, never discuss illness unless some special concern is shown. Seven, never pry into a person's personal circumstances. They'll tell you all eventually. Eight, never boast. Just let your importance be quietly obvious. Nine, never be untidy. And 10, never get drunk.
Wow, it's like the Ten Commandments in the Bible.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with those ones as well, but I've heard they're similar.
I think they're about the same.
So with these in his pocket, Lustig spent 5 years conning rich people on cruises out of money. swindling people by fixing games at gambling tables, or by often pretending to be a big shot Broadway producer looking for investments in a show that was about to open, which was obviously not real.
So was he hired by these cruises or these ships to like entertain people, or was he basically a stowaway?
No, well, he'd pay for a ticket.
Oh, he'd pay for a ticket.
Yeah, he had money. He was scamming people out of enough money that he could pay for a ticket.
Okay.
So he would basically, he would pretend to be affluent, right? So he would just get on board and try to, he knew that there was a lot of rich people around on cruises, so it's a really great place to be if you're a con man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And like I said, he was more refined than many other swindlers of the time that relied on gangster-like personas. He would often pretend to be extremely wealthy himself, going by titles of Count or Baron, to lure his marks into believing that he had no reason to scam them in the first place, as he already had plenty of cash in the coffers. Why would this man be lying to me? He's already rich.
Right.
Why would he want money off me? Honestly, really smart in a way.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Just really smart in like the worst way possible. Mm-hmm. With no morals. Smart with no morals is a bad. Oh,
that's a great combo, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Perfect.
Yeah, it's given us things like this.
Mm-hmm.
The atomic bomb.
Yep. Other stuff. The Playboy Mansion.
I don't know if I'd say smart.
It's a multi-million dollar business.
I get lucky. Yeah. Just because he was the first one to fucking put boobies in a magazine?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Brilliant.
Whoa. What an idea.
But brilliant boobs.
In 1914, as the world was plunged headfirst into World War I, Victor found his preferred means of connery to be no longer viable, as patrolling German U-boats drastically reduced transatlantic travel for the rich or the poor alike. And with this, he touches down semi-permanently for the first time in his second continent, North America. So moving to Kansas City, Missouri, Victor paired up with an accomplice who went by the name of Dapper Dan Collins and started a scheme that is only equaled in its apparent stupidity by its incredible success that went by the name of the Romanian Money Box Scheme. Count Victor would be staying at one of the many upscale hotels in whatever city he happened to be traveling through and would start a conversation with another wealthy individual. Throughout the evening, they would talk and get to know each other, when at some point in the evening, the source of Victor's immense wealth would be broached, after which he would pull out a small wooden box. Opening it up, he would reveal a wealth of intricate mechanical parts, levers, and printing equipment, and ask his mark for a $100 bill. He would insert the bill into one side of the box and operate the machinery, telling the mark that they would soon have two $100 bills in the short time of 6 hours, which is how long the printing process took. In this time, he would continue to work his silver tongue on them, and after the waiting period, he would indeed pull two $100 bills out of the box, identical down to the serial number. Then his guest would watch in astonishment as they went to a bank and Victor would deposit the bill with the cashier, of course, saying absolutely nothing.
See, and this is what brings up the very important print question of why can't we just print more money?
We can.
See?
If you want to end up like Argentina.
Don't cry for me. Don't cry for me, Argentina.
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't get the reference. Of course, the mark would ask how much the count would take to part with the box. But at first, he would feign as if he didn't want or could not part with the box.
These people believed this?
Yes. But after they offered a hefty sum of money, as much as $10,000 or $221,000 when adjusted for inflation, he would finally agree to part with it. Then, while the mark would wait the 12 hours necessary for the box to be used again, because there was a cool down period too. It takes 6 hours to print one hours till you got to print another one. That
makes sense. Makes sense.
Right. Victor and his accomplice would steal out of town to find another hotel and another gullible person to buy a useless wooden box.
That is so dumb.
So how this worked is that Victor would alter real $100 bills to have the same serial number. You'd go to the bank and get like a bunch of $100 bills and ask for them with serial numbers in succession so that they were easier to all make the same serial number. Then load one half of the box with a small stack of them, enough for as many demonstrations as he would need to convince the person. Then when they finally agreed to pay a high sum, he would make his money back in multiples for the small stack of $100 bills that he had surrendered. One of the most well-known stories involving the Romanian box, Victor and perhaps Dapper Dan, unsure, that's shrouded in mystery, had pulled the scam on a Texas sheriff, who, after realizing that he had been duped, set out to deliver some long arm of the law straight to the doorstep of Victor Lustig. The sheriff pursued the con men halfway across the country, all the way to Chicago, and finally found them. Upon meeting them, Lustig, don't know how he did it, found a way to convince the sheriff that he had simply been operating the box incorrectly the whole time. It was just user error. And Lustig decided, you know what, I'll pay you back a large sum of the money for the inconvenience. You followed us all the way here. So here's some money back. And that partial refund, foreshadowing, would really come back to bite the sheriff in the ass.
This is so dumb.
So just wait. Yeah, he pulled this for like years. Now, I mean, you got to remember this is like,
we have gotten smarter as a people.
This is the 1910s. So like there was quack machines going on. Like you can kind of get people to believe almost anything is real.
Yeah.
Because you can't just Google it. Hey,
well, that's true.
Hey, can small box printing money actually work? And one thing that's really smart about this that you'll kind of see with Victor throughout his schemes, and I'll mention it again later, is that it's also hard for a person who falls for the scam to go to the police.
Yeah.
Because you have to admit that you were trying to make counterfeit money.
Yeah.
In the process of saying
it's kind
of
like
scammed.
It's kind of like being like someone stole my drugs.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to drug deal. And then it's like, well, hold on. You're not supposed to be drug dealing.
Like, but they're a thief, you know? So kind of smart because no one would tell anyone about it, I guess. Yeah, he must have just been hella convincing.
Mm-hmm.
Also, because what the hell, man? You're going to fall for it a second time?
Two times.
You went across the country and you fall for it
again? Fool me once. Shame on you. Fool me twice. Shame on me. Oh, yeah,
the sheriff was dumb. During this tour of America, he also put his magic skills to good use on at least one occasion in 1922, when under the alias of Robert Duval, he took about $21,000.
Is that Shelley's dad?
It is, believe it or not. He took about $21,000 worth of World War I Liberty bonds into a bank. These bonds at this point were looking like they might never get repaid. I did read a little bit into World War I Liberty bonds. If you're really interested in that, go check it out. Some interesting stuff there. I won't bore you with it. So he was going to sell them below their value because they look like they were going to never get paid back. So he just wanted $10,000 in cash for the $21,000 in bonds. The bank agreed, but he used his sleight of hand to swap the envelope containing the bonds at the last minute for one just containing blank pieces of paper, and then just left with the bonds and the money.
Damn.
So, he pulled it. Now you see me, man.
Damn, this guy was crazy.
Smoothest criminal I ever lived?
Yeah.
Maybe. After drumming up enough trouble in America, he decided to return to the city of his youth, Paris, in or around 1925. And it was here that he would pull off the con that would fully cement his legacy as one of the best shysters in history. Okay, some backstory here. The Eiffel Tower, named after Gustave Eiffel, the principal engineer who designed and built it, was finalized in 1889 for the World's Fair held in Paris that year. The tower that has become so iconic was kind of hated by a large portion of the French.
Interesting.
Even before it was erected, a petition of artists was published in a local newspaper that read, and I quote, We, writers, painters, sculptors, architects, and passionate devotees of the hitherto untouched beauty of Paris, protest with all our strength, with all our indignation in the name of slighted French taste against the erection of this useless and monstrous Eiffel Tower. They hated this shit.
Wow, they really did. They did not want that.
No. And the hatred of the Eiffel Tower continued after it was built, with many citizens finding it ugly and garish, especially in relation to other architectural feats which were already present in the city, such as the Arc de Triomphe or the Palace of Versailles.
Well, I'm not going to lie to you. The Palace of Versailles is much more impressive than the Eiffel Tower.
Fair, but the Eiffel Tower is what people think of when they think of Paris.
Oh, yeah, it's the first thing.
So it's become hella iconic. I think of Eiffel Tower and that bridge with all the locks on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
Lost
it.
Bridge. It was funny because I told my ex when I went to Paris, I was like, I want to see the Lovelock Bridge. And he was like, why do you even know about that? And I was like, we all know about it.
It's a big thing in America.
Yeah.
All right. Especially they had to cut off all the locks because it was breaking the bridge.
I hope they broke off me and my ex's lock.
They probably did. I literally think they took like all of them off because they were like, this is crumbling our infrastructure. I think they release things all the time where they're like, please don't put any more locks on this bridge. You are going to destroy a French bridge.
Please with do all not of destroy these fucking our bridge. Locks. In comes a ship that's lost power.
Hey, this is Paris, not Pittsburgh.
Baltimore?
Yeah, whatever. All those East Coast cities. They're all the same. They're all the same. You see one, you see them all. Sorry, anyone that lives on the East Coast, of course. They thought the people in Paris in the 1880s. 90s. They thought they would not have to bear the eyesore long, however, because the original contract stated that it was to be torn down in 20 years.
What was the point then?
It was for the World's Fair.
It was just for the World's Fair.
Yeah, basically. So they held a competition where you could submit a design for a monument to be built for the World's Fair. And part of the contract even said that it had to be easy to dismantle because they were going to take it down in like 20 to 30 years.
Okay.
Like it would stay up for at least 20, maybe 30. So everyone was like, all right, it'll at least be out of here in 1909, right? We have to grin and bear it for 20 years. However, the tower showed some benefits to new technology, being the tallest human-made structure at the time. One of these uses was as a radio broadcast tower that later helped the French block German radio transmissions in World War II, but in 1925 provided Victor Lustig with a believable position in government to imitate. Victor Lustig first faked stationery to claim that he was the deputy director of the Ministerie Day Postis and Telegraphies, whatever.
Telegraphies is not how that's pronounced.
I don't fucking care, and I don't know. I don't do French. But he pretended to be from the Ministry of Posts and Telegraphs. I'll say it in English. To some prominent metal scrap dealers in Paris. He told them to meet him at an upscale hotel, the Hotel de Crillon, to discuss a lucrative government contract. Recently, the newspapers had been discussing how the upkeep costs of the tower were incredibly high, and there was genuine discussion about this being the time to tear it down. Upon the scrap dealer's arrival to the hotel, Lustig told them that the government decided they needed to find a buyer for the scrap metal from the Eiffel Tower, but that absolute discretion was needed to avoid rumors swirling in the public until the details of the contract were officially released. So, hey, hush, hush, we'll talk about it here, but don't go spreading it around. Lustig began sizing up the buyers as soon as he met them and settled on the perfect mark, Andrew Poisson. Poisson's business was newer to the scene, and therefore he was the most ambitious to secure the deal. In a private meeting with Poisson, Lustig told him that the decision of who would get the contract was his alone and a very big decision, and hinted at greasing the wheels a little bit so that they would turn in Poisson's favor. In the end, Poisson decided not only to pay the $50,000 to buy the tower from him, but to place an additional $20,000 in Lustig's personal purse just for the opportunity as a bribe.
A tip.
Yeah, tip. We'll call it that. A tip for a government official, which is just a bribe. After he closed his fist on the cash, though, Lustig fled the country to Austria and waited for the story to be printed in newspapers. This was a big score, after all. 70 grand in 1925
is a lot of money. It's a lot of money now.
Yes, but even more impressive. That I mean, now there are cars more expensive than that.
Oh, well, yeah.
But then?
No, that's a lot of money.
I didn't do the inflation calculator on this, but that feels like half a million at least. Probably. It's a lot of money.
Well, what'd you say earlier? 10,000 was 200,000?
Yeah, that was a little bit earlier. That was like 15 years earlier.
Yeah, it was probably around $500,000.
Either way.
Yeah. A lot of money.
But no story ever broke. It remained quiet. Poisson was so embarrassed at falling for the ruse that he never went to the police. And after the period of quiet, Victor attempted to push his luck by coming back to Paris to give it another go with new scrap metal dealers.
Okay, I think that you just need to take the win. Take the W and not do that again.
This is literally his life. This is what he does. And it worked. He secured another buyer. But this time, before he was actually able to get the money, secure the bag, Victor began to believe that one of them had notified the police, and he took his suitcase carrying multiple fake passports and fled back to the United States just in time for the Great Depression.
Ah, that was a perfect time to come back. Hey, good timing.
Hey, it is a great time if you're trying to scam people.
No, technically, they're poor.
Yeah, people are really desperate, which makes them very susceptible.
Damn.
But, ugh. So, supposedly returning to the Romanian box scandal upon getting back to the States.
No, bro.
He did for like another few years. Like, this is his like tried and true. Like, somehow this worked a lot. This is actually when he duped that Texas sheriff out of his $123,000 in tax receipts for it, which is what he paid for the box.
Well, then no wonder he was so upset, too, because it was during the Great Depression.
Exactly. And after he had dealt with the lawman in Chicago, Victor Lustig became even more bold in a deal with the terror of the city himself, Al Capone. The story goes that Lustig approached Capone with the idea for either a scam or a stock investment, some sort of investment, and promised to double his initial $50,000 investment. What Lustig really did was just take the money and like put it in a bank account or a lockbox and then do absolutely nothing. After a while, he came back to Capone telling him that the investment had gone bad and that he had lost all the money. But as a show of good faith, he would pay Capone back the money out of his own pocket. Capone supposedly respected the honesty of Lustig so much that he decided to let him keep $5,000. But it was $5,000 of his own money. The money was never
lost. That is crazy. I'm actually shocked that that went down that way.
Well, and all of this was supposedly just to gain the respect of him because he knew that he was powerful and he wanted to keep him as a friend. So he was like, I'll invest this. And then he was like, I'll just come and be like, pretend that I'm like a really honest man that I lost the money, but that I do him a solid and pay the money back. But he just held it.
And gave him his back own to him. Money.
And then Al Capone was like, here's $5,000, bud. Which was just icing on the cake.
Yeah. So he made $5,000.
Yeah. As far as I know, I don't know if anything else ever came out of that or if it was real. But hey, it's a good story nonetheless. In 1930, Victor would start on the path that would finally lead to his downfall, though. After years of selling a box that could supposedly print money and having to doctor $100 bills to do so, he finally made the connection, hey, maybe I should just cut out the middleman and actually just print the money. In conjunction with a Nebraska chemist, Tom Shaw, and engraver William Watts, they created plates, paper, and ink that would mimic the security threads present in U.S. currency. and the result was incredibly believable. They would print and introduce into circulation $100,000 worth of fake bills every single month, which the feds would later call...
A month?
Every month, which the feds would later call Lustig money. Although believable, the Secret Service, which, by the way, at the time was the only organization with federal jurisdiction, and they were only asked to secure the president, like do security for the president after this. First, they were a federal enforcement agency. They finally caught wind of these bills showing up at racetracks and gambling halls. Lustig was actually using couriers to these places to deliver the bills, and the couriers themselves didn't even know the money was fake. So it was really hard to trace the money back to Lustig because the couriers just thought that they were delivering actual bills. The feds did, however, finally find a man whom they could trace a large amount of the Lustig money back to, and they arrested him. And it just so turns out it was that sheriff, which Lustig had paid the refund for the Romanian box scam. The money he slipped him was counterfeit. And although the sheriff finally allowed the feds to connect the now almost $1 million in fake bills to a person, he told them about Victor Lustig, it still wasn't enough for him to avoid jail time. Oh,
this poor dumb idiot.
He went to prison.
Poor dumb idiot.
Just because he had all of this counterfeit money that he didn't think was fake.
He didn't know was fake.
That he got as recompense for falling for another scam.
Big dumb idiot.
Yeah. I kind of feel bad for this guy.
I feel bad for him.
This is actually... By the way, this is another one. It's like... It's hard to... For victims of his scams to go to the police. We talked about having to admit to counterfeiting, but even like Poisson, you'd have to, like, if he went to the police about the Eiffel Tower, he'd also either be out the $20,000 from the bribe he gave them, or he'd have to admit that he basically tried to bribe an official, both of which are pretty bad.
Yeah.
You know, he just had a really good knack for that. So what Victor's real downfall was, however, was the same thing that gave him that notable scar on his left eye, a jilted lady. Victor was married, but that did not stop him from getting some strange on the side, you know
Hell
what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And his favorite was a brothel runner named Billy May. After his wife supposedly found out that Lustig was housing his mistress in the exact same hotel as her in Pittsburgh, she decided that she had had enough and called in an anonymous tip about his whereabouts to the feds. And although at this time he was accustomed to carrying around a trunk with him that contained multiple disguises, including a priest and a bellhop, they found him strolling the streets outside of his hotel dressed only as himself in May of 1935. On his person, they found none of the counterfeit money. But they did find a key, and Lustig refused to tell them what it opened. They did a little quick detective work, and someone said, oh, I think that looks like a subway locker key, and they did find out that it was for a locker in the Times Square subway station. And when they opened it with the key, they found $51,000 in Lustig money and copies of the plates that were used to make them, and the ink. Upon his arrest, supposedly one of the detectives told Lustig that he was the, quote, smoothest con man in the world.
Don't tell him that.
To which Lustig replied, I wouldn't say that. After all, you've conned me. And this quote is what inspired the title of the main book on Lustig's life, which is entitled The Smoothest Con Man in the World. I didn't get to read it, but... It's got really good reviews on Amazon, so feel free to pop in and read that if you want a more in-depth look into this story. He was not in prison for long, however, as only a few months later in September of 1935, while awaiting trial, Count Victor had been stocking up on bedsheets, and he fashioned them into a rope that he used to scale
this trick.
The side of the prison. Onlookers say that he had pretended to be a window washer, wiping at the windows with a spare rag on his way down, and barely catching attention before jumping to the ground, bowing to those who did take the time to look, and running off into the world at large. But he only spent 3 weeks out of prison before recapture, and in November of 1935, he was finally tried, convicted, and sentenced to 20 years for his counterfeiting crimes. Supposedly, there were stories that he had actually been arrested at least 40 times before this, but had always either escaped the prison or just talked his way out of it.
I would understand talking his way out of it. I don't know how you escape prison that many times.
He seemed pretty good at it. He did it, at least did it once.
Yeah.
So, no one had seen the bedsheet rope before, obviously, so.
That's like the oldest trick in the book.
Well, maybe he was the inventor.
He wrote the book.
He invented so many other things. Maybe he invented the bedsheet rope for prison escapes. So this time, they had learned their lesson about Lustig's escapes, and they sent him straight to the Rock of Alcatraz to join his former scam victim, Al Capone.
And while he was there, Al Capone gave him syphilis.
Maybe. I don't know. He did file a lot of medical requests, so we'll see that. Known from then on as inmate number 300, since no one sussed out which of his passports, if any, held his real name, he filed multiple medical requests throughout his years at Alcatraz, over 1,400 in total, most of which actually went unheeded by the warden, who believed they were just part of Lustig trying to pull another jailbreak scheme of some sort. In 1947, though, his poor health was finally believed as they sent him to a hospital in Springfield, Missouri, where he would finally die on March 11th, 1947. On the death certificate, under occupation, the coroner decided to pull one final joke as a bow on Victor Lustig's life when he wrote, "Apprentice Salesman."
That's pretty good.
So thus ends the story of Count Victor Lustig, or Robert Miller, or Henry Duvall, or one of other countless names for which he was known to go by over the years. Maybe the smoothest criminal that ever lived, or maybe not. From my perspective, a good majority of these stories just have to be myths. You know, scamming Capone, the jealous lover that gave him the scar, selling the Eiffel Tower, all of these stories are supported by newspaper articles from the time. But as we've learned with H.H. Holmes and the death of Thomas Ince, the newspapers had a really bad track record of just printing absolute fiction, especially around this time, and calling it real. The original fake news. How much is not true, we'll never know. But likely, some of it is true. This didn't come from nowhere. I mean, Victor Lustig existed. We know this because his picture is forever on the historical records of Alcatraz. But if only 10% of the stories are true, Victor Lustig was still one smooth guy. And that's it for today. So if you liked our story of Victor Lustig, the smoothest con man in the world, then why don't you show us some love, huh, guys? Why don't you subscribe on whatever podcatcher that you're listening to? If that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify, go ahead and leave us a rating. 5 stars. I like the Victor Lustig episode. That shit's crazy. Don't say shit. I don't know if you can do that.
That episode is crazy.
Thank you for censoring me. Go ahead and write a review if you're on Apple Podcasts. That's a great way to support us. And you can also support us for free by following our socials and also connect with us there. Facebook.com/WhiteCollarsRedHands, Twitter at WhiteCollarsPod, Instagram at WhiteCollars_RedHands, TikTok at WhiteCollarsRedHands. You can get in touch with us there, interact with us there. We love hearing from you guys. So please, please do that. If you want to contact us more directly, you can email us too. That's WhiteCollarsRedHands@gmail.com. You can also use any of those to suggest episodes. We do a fan submitted episode every single season. Our one for this season is coming up in a couple of weeks. I think it's number 4. Don't hold me to it though. I don't remember things without looking at my schedule.
Yeah, we gotta look at the schedule. I'm not sure,
but it's on there. We have one. Don't worry. And you could be the one for season 16. So go ahead and contact us through any one of those outlets. You can also drop us a line over at our website. That's whitecollarsredhands.com. There's a contact us page there. That also goes straight to our email. So whatever you want to do. And hey, while you're there, click that button that says check out our merch and go buy a shirt, buy a sweatshirt, buy a mug, buy a tote bag, buy a sticker. I don't know.
Any of the above.
All of the above. Might as well go and get it. And you know what would really help us out? Tell it a friend.
Yes.
Right? You have friends, I'm assuming.
Or we hope.
Right? You have friends. Someone out there likes you. Probably. Go tell them that they should listen to this new podcast you've been into, and it's called White Collars Red Hands, and then just play them this 5-minute long outro. I'm sure that won't be boring.
This will convince them.
Yeah. Is this not... I'm about to say like vigorously irritating you. Maybe it is vigorously irritating you.
I hope not.
And I feel like that's the sign that we should end it.
Yes, please.
So thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week on another episode of White Collars, Red Hands.